Welcome to this week's Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we begin our two-part series on 1968, a crucial year in a crucial decade. Today we'll discuss developments in the civil rights movement with historian John McCartney and hear the opinion of veteran civil rights leader Julian Bond. But before we do that, let's look back at a significant and related event in history. On December 1, 1955, returning home from a long day at work, seamstress Rosa Parks, an African-American, refused to give up her seat on a city bus to a white man. Parks was arrested. Local black leaders, including a still largely unknown young preacher, Martin Luther King Jr., rallied to her cause, and the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott began. It lasted a year, but when it was over, the city's buses were desegregated, and the Montgomery bus boycott went down in history as the event that sparked the American Civil Rights Movement. Turning to this week's history in the news, the nation's first museum dedicated to the Vietnam War has opened in Holmdel, New Jersey. The committee organizing the museum has spent most of the last year arguing over interpretations, wording of text panels, and just what should be displayed, but compromises have been reached. The $3.8 million center is a welcome addition to the ongoing national dialogue on America's longest war. And did the FBI confuse Groucho with Karl? Famed comedian Groucho Marx caught more than just the attention of the entertainment world with his wisecracking quick humor in the 1950s. As recently released documents reveal, the FBI kept detailed files on the comedian, including his support of the Scottsboro Boys, membership in freedom of speech organizations, and cutting jokes made against the United States government. The FBI never interfered with Groucho's career and in the end concluded that he was not a member of the Communist Party. You are listening to Talking History.
Watching you, the ship roll in, and I watch you roll away.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, on December 1st, we mark the 43rd anniversary of the Montgomery bus boycott, the event that sparked the American Civil Rights Movement. The movement continued into the 1960s, and like other movements of that decade, produced some remarkable developments in 1968. Here to discuss those developments is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik, who will be talking to historian John McCartney.
Thank you, Brian. It's been 30 years since the dramatic events of 1968 traumatized the United States. The anniversary has produced several new books and a PBS documentary that tried to put the turmoil into historical perspective. Talking History will devote two programs to the issue. First, today, since many of the events of 1968 grew out of the Civil Rights Movement, we will assess the significance of that year for African-American activists. To put it in perspective, our guest today, Dr. John T. McCartney, head of the Department of Government and Law at Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania, and the author of the book Black Power Ideologies, published by the Temple University Press. Welcome, Dr. McCartney.
Good to be here.
Thank you. Of the numerous important events of 1968, which one do you think had the greatest effect on the greatest number of African Americans?
I think, without a doubt, the assassination of Dr. King had not only the deepest effect on African Americans, but I think America at large, because it represented the passing of the era of civil rights, with its stress on morality and ethics as a way to achieve change. Also, at the same time, there was an optimism about America during that civil rights period, symbolized with Dr. King. After Dr. King's death, we see a change in focus. I think America, certainly blacks, are more pessimistic about the society, and the focus in terms of action is more political. Now, the people want to get out the vote, they want to influence Congress. We see, partly as a result of Dr. King's efforts passing the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, blacks now are a critical mass in the electorate all over the U.S., and we see caucuses, black caucuses of all kinds being formed, black power coalitions being formed with other groups. In fact, the Black Congressional Caucus, it seems to me, is a good symbol of the change from a sort of ethics, the appeal of conscience, to a politics of power, which I think blacks have played since that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the first immediate reactions to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, was a wave of riots across the country. How did that affect the situation?
I think despite the civil rights gains that were made, and I think the significance of them came, we saw the impact a little bit later, I think blacks, especially in the cities, saw American authority, the ruling circles, their mayors, even at the local level, their mayors, their representatives, the police department, as unresponsive to black people's needs. And it seems to me that the riots of the 1960s was an effort to at least try to correct that situation. Here you have people now enfranchised with civil rights, but they're being treated on jobs and treated in the street, treated by the police as if they're in an occupied country. I think these rebellions, as the blacks call them, were a response to this kind of a white disdain for blacks.
I see. Now, many conservative whites claimed that those riots were a black power conspiracy. Do you think that's true?
Certainly not. I think these were legitimate expressions of frustration, especially by young people. Young people who couldn't get jobs, young people who were being asked to go to war in Vietnam thousands of miles away when they didn't have civil rights in Chicago or Los Angeles, as the case may be, couldn't work. And so I think it was a combination of international relations, internal frustration that led to these riots. And I think, above all, disappointment that despite years of civil rights work, the country had not delivered.
Mm-hmm. Again, a lot of critics associate violence with black power ideology. Would you make the same connection?
Definitely not. I think that has been one of the misreadings of the black power movement. I think the manifestations of violence were compared to the progressive kinds of organizations and changes that were made, very minor. I think black power was an effort, and I think black power could only occur, by the way, after blacks had achieved the civil rights that Dr. King fought for. I think the black power movement was a movement in all areas of life in America, in the church, in the economy, in the universities, etc., to assert black dignity, which they realized, the black experience, black culture, which had been neglected for so long. University curriculums, for example, jobs, which were all white. The Black Power movement was an effort then to inform the society of the black presence, and then to show how that it was positive. And the society was losing by not making it an integral part of the system. So, for example, you found on university campuses students and professors demonstrating to get black studies programs or black studies courses. You saw in unions blacks forming caucuses in the unions. These are not violent activities by and large. These are activities to demand recognition and respect. And so I think when the Black Power movement is depicted as one as synonymous with violence, I think that's a misreading of the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. So then, for example, the Black Panther Party, and then, like in 1968, a shootout with police in Oakland. How would you place this in the perspective of black power ideologies?
I think the Black Panther situation in the cities, like Los Angeles, Huey Newton, and the others, in these cities of the United States, these were the places where blacks were, if they were living in say, colonized Africa. Blacks didn't feel a part of the system. They had no representation. they were violently treated by the police. The police saw the black community in many respects as you know, enemy territory. I think the Black Panther Party's efforts were in a sense, targeted to redress that, and to redress it in a confrontational way, which is perhaps the only way in certain cases the plight could be understood. Not that I agree with what was done, I mean, violence or the carrying of guns, but I think the purposes of it was to assert this dignity and to exclaim, we are not a colonized people, we are Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Kerner Commission reported in 1968 and studied the violence in American cities. How was it received by different aspects of the black community?
The Kerner Commission, still used by me in my classes as a sort of watershed study, because I think other than Gunnar Myrdal, you know, earlier in the 40s, he came up with his American Dilemma. There had been no effort, certainly by the government up to that time, to systematically look at the root causes of black inequalities in the United States. I think the Kerner Commission used data to confirm what blacks had been saying about America all along. They confirmed the fact that the black future, by and large, though some progress had been made, the black future did not look very good in the society. And I think blacks always refer to the Kerner Commission report to show exactly how they were in a sense, oppressed during the 60s.
I see. Okay. And, I mean, did moderate blacks and various strains of black power advocates react in the same way to the report?
I think so. I think, as you recall, the Kerner Commission report started out by saying the root causes of the riots or rebellions in the cities was white racism. White racism was at the root cause of these problems, and until you had a society where whites and blacks could live together in a respectful way, you'll continue to have these kinds of disturbances. So I think whether or not, you know, a black conservative agreed with some of the tactics of the Panthers or vice versa, they all, in a sense, cheered when they saw a government-sponsored commission coming up with that kind of conclusion.
Mm-hmm. In a similarly dramatic, symbolic sense, do you think blacks had the same response to Tommy Smith and John Carlos when they did the Black Power salute on the stanchion at the Mexico City Olympics when they received their medals?
I think so. You know, I mentioned earlier that in many respects, blacks saw themselves as a colonized people, meaning you're taken for granted too. And you know, one segment of black society that has contributed so much to America's culture has been our athletes. And the athletes, by and large, was seen as raw material to be used to further America's interests in the world, to give us glory, and etc. But they were not seen as thinking people attached to the problems of America and conscious of these problems and attached to their communities and the problems in them. I think when John, Carlos, and Smith raised the Black Power fist, they were signaling the fact that, look, we can't be taken for granted any longer. We don't disconnect our success in sports from what we see as the degradation of our communities. And then we're using sports as a way to show this. So I think as a symbol of blacks, especially athletes, identifying with the black challenge, 1968 was a key event.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Another key event of 68 that relates to what we've been discussing was the Poor People's March. In this scheme of riots and problems, black power ideologies, where would you place the Poor People's March that Martin Luther King himself had initiated
Exactly. Before
his assassination?
The more you study King and what he did, takes sometimes 20 years to see his vision. But you know, blacks have made gains in America. The slavery, 60%, the middle class and upper class, training and skills. But we have a 40% underclass in the central cities and so on, who are not making any gains in America. I think the Poor People's March was an effort by Dr. King and the people who supported him to focus on the problems of the black underclass, to show that they were there, that they were not making any gains, that their problems needed to be addressed, and that it was, if America was to fulfill its promise, slavery, even the black community was to fulfill its promise, that underclass had to be eradicated. Unfortunately, I think perhaps as big today as it was when Dr. King was marching, and I don't think any groups, certainly any national leaders, have had the kind of persona to sponsor the kind of march or make a success out of a Poor People's March like Dr. King apparently was on the way to doing. We have, of course, groups like the Black Muslims who address a segment of the underclass. But the broad underclass is not Muslim, black Muslim, it's just there. It's supposedly part of America, but we haven't had anyone since King to try and directly address this problem in the way that he did.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about national leadership and the addressing of problems, I mean, in 1968, we lost Martin Luther King, but on the other hand, we saw the election of Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to serve in the United States Congress. What was her ideology, and how does she fit in the grand scheme of the civil rights movement?
Right. Shirley Chisholm was a very remarkable woman, has not been really studied enough. First of all, I think she was a prime exemplar of American values and the possibilities of America, coming from an immigrant family and succeeding, going to get an education. And Shirley, of course, saw the possibilities in America, very liberal possibilities. And what made her so important was not only that she was a woman who took on male chauvinism and all the other things associated with it, but she never lost sight of the fact that the black community was vibrant and could play a very decisive role in liberal America. So Shirley Chisholm used her efforts to rally that black community. And when she got in Congress, she used her base in the black community to make the kind of coalitions that could advance blacks, black welfare, black education, and so on. So I think she was a proud woman, a proud exponent of black power, who tried to show, and I think showed pretty well, that black power could be achieved within the American system.
And when you say black power in the American system, what do you mean?
By black power, I mean blacks could achieve their just proportion of the American pie. Not today, but by skillfully using the political parties, using their power in the central cities, using their votes to force other interests in America to accede to some of their demands. So to put it another way, I think Shirley Chisholm tried to show that black power is not racist. Black power means exercising traditional American tools to get ahead, to vote, education, so on, by organizing and by being unified.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That's
all the time that we have. I want to thank our guest, Dr. John T. McCartney of Lafayette College.
There's no man alive better situated to comment on the civil rights movement of the 1960s than Julian Bond. Currently a distinguished scholar in residence at American University, Bond began his long career as an activist in 1960 when he helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He went on to be elected president of the Atlanta, Georgia branch of the NAACP, a post he held for 11 years and then to four terms on the NAACP's National Board of Directors. Bond served several terms in the Georgia House of Representatives and Senate and was recently named by Time Magazine one of America's top 200 leaders. The title of Julian Bond's op-ed is Black Power's Rise and Effects.
1968 was one of those magic and frightening years in American political life. Assassinations, protests, generational and racial divisions, not only here but all across the globe. By 1968, a mass nonviolent movement, led by black Americans but attracting support across racial lines, had succeeded in eliminating legal segregation at places of public accommodation and the ballot box. Suddenly, black Americans gained access to lunch counters and movie theaters and bus front seats and voting booths. The number of black voters swelled, and soon the number of blacks elected to public office too. But almost immediately after winning these victories, it became clear to the movement that legislation alone would not be sufficient to erase 300 years of white supremacy. Something more was required. Lacking the ability to change the hearts and minds of majority Americans, or to make them welcome minority populations their culture and history taught them to despise and avoid, a sector of the civil rights movement turned inward, seeking cultural change within black America and to renegotiate the compact between blacks and whites. Although this movement was widespread and tremendously varied, it soon fell under a general description, black power. For many onlookers, it seemed hostile to whites and appeared to reject the democratic values of the American majority. But its proponents resisted that description. Rather, they argued, they wanted an honest and open relationship between the races, one built on a strong and well-organized black community that could negotiate from a position of strength. Now, these many years later, the rhetoric of the black power movement has faded, but its results are clear everywhere about us. But we'd be seriously mistaken to imagine that all is well, that victories won in the middle and late 1960s are secure today. Instead, there is a continual and ongoing assault on black power. If that term is understood to mean blacks having power whites have always enjoyed, whites sharing power with blacks. There is a general assault on affirmative action, the general programs responsible for overcoming much of the employment and educational apartheid that so restricted black lives. The nation has made a lot of progress since 1968. Recent announcements about poverty and high school graduation rates are welcome reminders that progress does occur, however slowly, however imperfectly. But there is obviously much left undone. The gaps between black and white life chances are still too great for anyone to sit back in self-congratulation or for the important protections of the 1960s to be weakened or removed. Divisions of race are our greatest national challenge. There is much required from all of us if we're to meet the crucial test of the worth of our democracy. First is an honest admission by the beneficiaries of skin privilege of the many unearned advantages they receive because of it. Without acknowledging that discrimination produces and protects winners, we're not going to get very far. Next, we've got to acknowledge that removing the stain of bigotry from our society is too important to be left to leaders alone. There's a task here for each of us. There is something somewhere each of us can do, whatever our talent and skills, if we have the will. In the late 1960s, we seemed to have the common will to make the changes that would guarantee equality for all. In the late 1990s, it isn't too late to test our will again.
You've been listening to American civil rights leader Julian Bond. The American Civil Rights Movement is one of those major events in history that has been well documented, not only in words, but on film. For our site of the week, here is Talking History's Cindy Workman to describe a photographic exhibit on the Civil Rights Movement that may be coming to a museum near you.
We Shall Overcome, Photographs from the American Civil Rights Era, is a collection of images from some of the best photographers of that time. Photos of Martin Luther King, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Julian Bond are among the collection of 75 photographs which can be seen at the Tubman African American Museum in Macon, Georgia until December 13th. And then the exhibit moves to the New York State Museum in Albany on January 15th, where it will stay until February 28th.
Thank you, Cindy. And turning to our coming attractions, we've yet one more opportunity for our listeners to immerse themselves in the 1960s, this time at the National Museum of American History, where a new exhibit is just opened titled A Visual Journey, Photographs by Lisa Law. Law's work provides a visual record of 1960s popular culture, including icons Bob Dylan, the Beatles, and Janis Joplin, and scenes from the anti-war movement and communal living. Contact the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. for further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for the second show in our series on the year 1968. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
About the man she saw. When she took her picture and went to the well, water she intended to draw.